following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Outlines as we are right over in this period, 850 years living in the land of Israel, which is a period of time that's going to encompass Joshua, the period of Judges we're going to look at today, and the monarchy, all through the period of the First Temple, down to the destruction of the First Temple by the Babylonians. So that's the material we're going to do in the next couple of classes. Today I'd like to focus primarily on the book of Judges, which is the next book in the Bible, after the book of Joshua. Very interesting period of time in Jewish history is the period of the Judges. First of all, it encompasses, depending upon how you calculate it, but generally I like to say 16 different people are going to be judges. There's breaks in between these people, by the way. It includes a period of 365 years, from after Joshua through till Samuel, who is one of the great prophets in Jewish history and who's the transitional figure between the judges and the monarchy. And the period of time runs generally from, if you want to know the calendar dates, in secular calendar dates, it's about 1244 BCE until 879, which is until the first monarchy. Okay, that's Jewish calendar dates. Okay, now it's a very interesting period of time in Jewish history in that there's no central leadership. Joshua, like Moses, is a strong central leader. When he dies, the Jewish people, basically, we have a loose tribal confederation. I mentioned last class that when we settle the land of Israel, which is described in the book of Joshua, each of the 12 tribes gets a specific geographic portion of the land of Israel. Okay, and that's what's going on in this period of time. And for these first X hundreds of years, basically what the Jewish people are doing is settling and developing their real estate. Okay, but there's no strong central government after Joshua is gone. Okay, you have a loose, sort of like America in the early years of the colonies. The federal government of the United States is now a very, very large entity with a huge budget and, you know, standing army. And this stuff is all, if you know the history of America, it's a big debate. America is very interesting. There's a lot of parallels between the United States and early biblical state of Israel in terms of the development. You had a lot of very loose, autonomous, independent groups of people trying to function together. Now, if you read in the beginning of the book of Judges, which is, I'll read you a quote from chapter 2, verses 8 through 14. This is how the Bible describes what's going on at the time. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, and also all that generation were gathered to their forefathers. And there arose another generation after them who knew not the Lord nor the deed which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord. And they forsook the God of their forefathers, and they went after other gods. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of spoilers, and he gave them over into the hands of their enemies. So first of all, it looks like simple reading of the story. And remember, I said this several times before. When you read the Bible, ideally you should read it in Hebrew, and you have to read it with the commentaries. You have to get all that oral tradition stuff that explains what's really going on here. Because a simple reading of this in English sounds like Joshua dies, and all the Jewish people get attracted to all the remaining Canaanite idolaters in the neighborhood, and they all leave Torah and they forget everything. Now, if that was the case, we wouldn't be sitting in this room today. Okay, I have to remember something very, very important about it. I mentioned this before, how the Bible criticizes the Jewish people. You all heard the expression, love is blind? Okay, it's one of the great untrue expressions. Love is not blind. Infatuation, lust is blind. And they meet this girl, she's so beautiful, she's perfect. You know. Believe me, you're going out for a year, you realize you can't stand to look at her anymore. You know, love, real love is not blind. I mean, who do you think knows you better than any human being on the planet Earth?
God.
Right. God, obviously, but God's not a human being on the planet Earth. Mom. Mom. Believe me. And parents in general. Like, I always tell, you know, my kids, I know, God is one of I tell my kids, you know, I know what you think you're going to think. I know what you think you're going to do even before you think you're going to think you're going to do it. No, you parents have a magnifying glass for the faults and weaknesses of their kids, but they love their kids because, and the Jewish definition of love is that, because you choose to focus on the beauty that's within that individual and you identify the person with those positive traits. Okay? Believe me, God, the all-knowing, infinite intelligence, all-powerful human being, knows the faults of the Jewish people better than anyone. And he also has a special relationship with us. And we have a special position of responsibility. And God, like a good parent who has a relationship with us and is not into neglectful parenting, is going to have a magnifying glass for our faults, not to make us neurotic, but because God's saying to us, I really want you to succeed, and I want you to do it as painlessly as possible. And therefore, when I criticize you, I'm going to do it in the strongest possible way to pound it into your very stiff-necked skulls that what you're doing is wrong. Okay, and so therefore, the criticism in the Bible is hyper-criticism, meaning it's blown way, I've said this before, it's blown way out of proportion to what's going on. So obviously, you can be sure that if all the Jewish people had forgotten God and worshipped idols, we wouldn't be here. And you can also be sure, if 12 Jews out of 3 million were worshipping idols, the Bible would record it, and all the Jewish people left God and worshipped idols. And that brings us back to the idea I talked about yesterday of collective responsibility. Right? If one Jew is worshipping an idol, the entire Jewish people are going to pay for that. Collective responsibility. For two reasons. One, because you're responsible, every Jew is responsible for every other Jew. And two, and this you can see, it's such an obvious point in the moral history of the world. As soon as you tolerate something in the world, it becomes bearable. Before long, it'll become common. I remember as a little kid, to kill a police officer was unheard of. No one ever thought to shoot a police officer. And I remember by the 70s, shooting police officers every day. You can shoot a police officer, no problem. Once you start tolerating things in society, it'll seep and it's like a disease. You know, you don't excise the germs from the body, it spreads throughout the entire body. God says you're a very high spiritual level. If you allow even small impurities into your body, it's going to pollute everything. So we have this hypercriticism here. And by the way, just to show you that it's not exactly what's going on, the Talmud, Avodah Zorah, which is on 25a, it says, it calls this book, Judges, which is Shoftim in Hebrew, it calls it Sefer HaYashar. Anyone know what Yashar means? Straight. Okay? In many ways, this is one of the high points of Jewish history. Why? And this is a very interesting point as a lesson to learn. We say in Judaism, you know, the most godlike thing a human being has, you know, we have this soul, which gives us our ability to choose. The more you exercise the ability to choose, the more human and therefore godlike you are, and the more you're being responsible in the world. The ultimate thing a Jew is supposed to do is to work it out for himself and to use the Bible as a guide and be dedicated to truth and make the right decisions. When someone tells you what to do, you're already abrogating your free will. Okay? So in many ways, when you're dealing with a situation like this with no strong leadership, when every Jew, and it says, and everyone did that which was right in his eyes. That's the description in the book of Judges, which sounds like anarchy. It wasn't anarchy. It means the vast majority of Jews were totally dedicated to Torah. And we're using Torah and new Torah and we're making decisions in the right way and didn't have to have someone telling him what to do, which is why the Talmud says this is in many ways an ideal situation. You had a question, Max?
This is kind of an observation, because I remember maybe I've misunderstood you, but yesterday I think it was talking about the molten calf, the incident of the molten calf, and how, if, again, the hypercritical writing in the Torah said, like, you know, it was only 3,000 people. So it really wasn't the whole of Jewish people.
It was 0.1%, right?
0.1%. So
exactly.
It wasn't as bad. See, because what I'm hearing is two messages. One, we're responsible for everyone's responsible for everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if one Jew falls, it's going to reflect badly on all of us. And yet, the sin of the molten calf wasn't really as bad as everyone thinks it is, because it was only 0.1%.
Right.
I'm hearing two different messages. It wasn't as bad as everyone thinks it was. Not everyone was like worshiping idols. This was only a small amount, but it really was as bad.
It was, meaning the consequences, the physical description of the story is not what it happening, but the consequences are, if God's saying in that language, he's saying, watch out, you've done something really wrong. Understand? So what you're saying is basically right. It wasn't the actual description of what was going on was not what was really going on. The Bible is overstating the case to pound home a point. But the reason is God saying, even though you really all didn't do it, the consequences of your actions are very, very severe. In many, it's as if you all did. You know, maybe we'll talk about it afterwards. It makes sense to me.
I'm just trying to make sense of it on a certain level. It's like someone in this classroom, one person would get up and be talking throughout the class and being disrespectful to you, would I necessarily be held accountable for that? If I'm listening and taking notes?
From my eyes, I might say, look, you guys, it's your responsibility, all of you, your class, to get everyone to behave properly in the class. I'm walking out. That's one level of behavior.
This is the way
the Bible's saying is collective responsibility. Yes, it is your responsibility. If one person misbehaves, you're responsible to get that person into line. Okay, I don't want to go into whether you agree with that or not. We'll be here all day. It's an interesting moral, ethical question. But I'm not just saying that's the way the Bible is more or less describing it as.
So I'm going to ask you, which of the commentators brings down the golden calf that was only a tenth of a percent?
Well, Rashi makes a comment on it, and I have to check exactly which sources give the exact number of it. But I'll find out for you. Okay. Now, by the way, the lack of leadership here has also a certain negative consequence too, in that if there are bad influences, there's no one really around to get the Jewish people into line. Now, it is clear, as although we're not anywhere near as bad as the opening statements of the book of Judges in this chapter 2 is saying, there's definitely mistakes being made. We didn't get rid of the Canaanites. Some Jews are being influenced by the Canaanites, and there's no one there to really deal with it the way it should be dealt with. So what happens? Now, by the way, go back to that quote again about in Judges chapter 2, verses 8 through 14. It says something, hold on one second, it says something very important, which is lesson number 2 here. It says, in the anger of the Lord, it says, and they forsook the God of their fathers, and they went after other gods. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of spoilers, and he gave them over into the hands of their enemies. So what's going on here? This is one of the most important patterns we have to understand how human history works. We do something wrong in our relationship with God, and therefore something external happens to us. An enemy comes and attacks us. Now, when I say in our relationship with God, I mean doesn't just mean in our relation to commandments that have to do with between man and God. Relationship with God means Torah, which is the system for us as a people. It's our model. Has two components to it: man and man to God, and you have to do both. The most oft-repeated idea in the Bible in terms of a prophecy is keep Torah, meaning keep all the commandments, the ritual stuff, right? And also keep that part which is between you and your fellow man. You can't eat glatt kosher food and cheat in business and say horrible things about your neighbor and think you're being a good Jew. You have to do both parts. Often we forget that, by the way. There's some segment of the Jewish world today which is obsessed with the man-to-man stuff, the liberal ideas, and there's a certain segment that's obsessed with the man and God stuff. It could care less. You have to do both. But God says over and over again, the most common prophecy, keep Torah, all facets of it, and no one will bother you. You won't have any external threats. You will live in peace in your land. You will prosper. And not only that, the whole world will come to learn from you, and you will elevate the entire planet up to the level it's supposed to be at. Don't do that, either part of it. You know, be nasty to each other, or forget about me, worship idols, hate your fellow man, whatever. And I'll send. Now, God doesn't, a big fist doesn't come out of heaven like swat us. You know, God acts in history. He says, I will send someone, some people, some enemy, some disaster, whether it be a physical enemy or a famine. I'll send something to smack you up, to wake you up, to get you in line. Therefore, and this is such an important lesson, it can't be stressed enough, Jews have to always realize when things happen to us, and remember in Judaism, nothing happens by chance. There's a God who acts in history, no accidents. When something happens to us bad, it's because of something, some decisions we have made. It is always a consequence of our actions. And therefore, the remedy is never to deal solely with the external threat. Enemy attacks us? Yes, you have to fight them off. But that means there's a bigger problem going on. Okay? It's such an important idea. We see it in the judges. Therefore, the people who are going to rise up during this period of time, who are called the judges, who appear, they disappear. Some rule for as little as 3 years. Some rule for 40 years, even more. Okay, some are very, very righteous people. Depending upon the level we're at, we get a judge, a different level of judge, depending upon what level we're at, depending upon the threat also. But those people who are going to rise up are going to appear, and they're going to do two things. They're going to unify the people, get the Jewish people to do tshuva. They're going to judge us, get us to get our act together, deal with the spiritual problems in the nation, and also deal with the physical threat. You have to do both at once. So the judge has a joint function, a military leader to deal with the outside threat, but the real power of a judge is that they are the legal authority, the Torah authority in the Jewish world. And by the way, that's another important thing to focus on, that therefore all of these people, although they're dealing with military aspects, and some of them are mighty men of valor, like we'll see in a few of them we'll talk about, Gidon and Yiftach and especially people like Samson. There, to be a judge, you can't just bench press 750 pounds. To be a judge, you got to be a Talmud Chacham. Okay, you can have muscles and brain. In the case of someone like Dvorah, she wasn't a warrior. If the best man for the job is a woman, she gets the job. But it's very important to understand what's going on here and to realize throughout Jewish history that everything that happens to us for a reason. And what's most interesting of all of this is, and I'll show you throughout the course of the classes, we have lots of accounts of Jews describing some of the horrible tragedies in Jewish history, communities being destroyed during the Crusades and what do you name it. You will never see during this whole period of time, virtually no example of Jews saying, until modern times, until the Holocaust, until the last 100 or so years, you'll never find Jews even living through horrendous things, even losing members of their families, saying, where's God? It's not fair. You will, however, find, and I'll show you numerous examples of Jews saying, you know why the Crusaders have slaughtered our entire community? You know what? It's because we have blown it. We didn't do what we're supposed to do. This is happening to us for a reason. We are responsible. That's incredibly high level. I'm not talking about in a biblical time. I'll read you accounts from a couple hundred years ago, and you'll see it's very clear for Jews who understand what our responsibility is and how God acts in history. This is an idea we've always been in touch with. Now most of the Jewish world has lost it. Why has it lost it? Because we lost Judaism. When the messenger forgets the message and the Jews walk around not believing in God, yet angry at him for the Holocaust. I always found it very interesting. I'm not religious. I don't really believe in a God who acts in history, but I'm really mad at him. I don't want to get into suffering now. Let's not bring it up as an issue if you want. Okay. But I'm saying, it's a very important lesson to focus on in Jewish history. Okay. We are responsible. What happens to us for a reason. And if we do what we're supposed to do, we don't have problems. And that, of course, you can extrapolate that to all circumstances, including the problems with our Arab cousins in the Middle East. The solution is never just to try and deal with that external threat, but to realize that if we're not together as a people and doing what we're supposed to do, that thorn that is in our side will never disappear. Yeah.
Just a quick comment. Just addressing what you said, it's, I guess what one would see is that, you know, throughout the centuries, you see the righteous along with the not so righteous getting the same punishment. And so one would tend to think, it's like, well, wait a minute. This person's doing all the mitzvot, he's really pious, and yet he's being, you know, tortured just like this other guy who didn't do him. So what's the diff?
It's excellent. It's an excellent question. Again, without getting too much into it, the best explanation, I think, is first of all, the idea of collective responsibility. But the best explanation is one of our favorite pieces of Gemara, of Talmud and Eshet Torah, which is the Gemara and Shabbos, which tractates Sabbath, which talks about the famous story when God is about to destroy the temple. And he tells the angels to go down. Of course, this is all very metaphorical and allegorical. He says the angels go down and put marks on the heads of the righteous people because I'm going to save them. The wicked are going to perish. The temple's going to be destroyed. The wicked are going to perish. And the accusing angel says, what do you mean you're going to save the righteous people? It was their responsibility to get the wicked people to do tshuva, to come back, to criticize them. So God says, but I know, because God knows everything outside time and space. God says, but I know they wouldn't have listened. And the angel says, but they didn't try. And God says, you're right. Go put marks on the heads of the righteous people. I'm going to kill them first. That's a heavy idea. That is a really heavy idea. Those who know have a much higher level of responsibility and accountability. The biggest mistake, and I'm going to stop with the moralizing, this is a history class, but the biggest mistake Jews could make, even in the modern Jewish world, in the religious world, is to think, I will escape into my religious ghetto and let not only the rest of the world go to pot, but let my 90% of my Jewish brethren who aren't religious just remain lost and disappear. We are all cells in one body. You don't say, oh, I have this cancerous growth, God forbid, in my arm, but to hell with my arm, it can just fall off and I'm just going to go have a good time in Bermuda. If you do that, you're going to be dead in a few months. Okay, that is the Jewish people. Kol Yisrael Ravim Zeh LaZeh. It is such an important idea. We have to understand. It's one of the driving ideologies behind Rabbi Noach Weinberg and Eshet Torah. That's why that Talmud, that piece of Talmud in the Sabbath, is one of his favorite pieces of Talmud. It's a very heavy lesson. And you see it in the Holocaust. You can see it all throughout Jewish history. I don't want to get into more. It's not the topic of the class. But yes, sir, one more question. Let's go forward. It's the name given by the Talmud refers to. It's not the official name of the book. But it says, you know, we also call this book. It's really the book of the straight. Because these people really, in many ways, had their act together. Now, without going through all of the judges, we have 16 different characters. The first one, by the way, is Otniel ben Knaz, and the last one being Samuel the prophet. Just a couple of them are very interesting. One is, I want to give you a few highlights of the period. And again, some of them are very illustrious, and some of them, like Yiftach, are from he's like a bastard, illegitimate son who's brought in because the Jewish people have no one better. And he's not a bad guy. He's a great military leader. But he's not on the same level as someone like Devorah or Barak, who jointly rule for 40 years. Okay, she is, again, it's a very interesting example. The best man for the job is a woman. She does it. Although it's interesting, Devorah, as a judge, had to pass judgment. She was the chief legal legislative decision maker in the Jewish people. She would not sit in a courthouse. She would sit only under a palm tree. Okay, it was her way of saying, really, guys, this is not my job. This is a guy thing to do. Okay, power thing, you know. I'll do it because I'm the best person, but I'm going to do it in a not quite normal way. I'm going to do it sitting under this dekel, this palm tree. So you realize a little bit different. You have, again, Yiftach HaGiladi, who's the 12th judge. He ruled for 6 years. Again, he's the son of a prostitute, which is also very interesting that in Jewish history, we don't hide any of the bad yichus, we say, of any of our great figures. You know, it's interesting, in the history, if you look at history of other people, which is never even close to being objective, it's very subjective, they always whitewash the origins of anyone who has maybe a tainted background. We'll see whether you're looking at David's background or you name it, we don't hide anything. Again, he's the best guy for the job, he does it. One of the more interesting people is the 16th of the judges, whose name is Samson, Shimshon, who rules for 20 years. He's interesting because he's one of the few, he's an unusual kind of what's called a nazir. He's one of the few macho heroes of the Jewish people. Now, it's an interesting point when you look at Jewish history in general. We don't have macho heroes in Judaism. And you look at world history, leaders, heroes by definition are warriors, and warriors by definition are the most macho of all guys. If you look in the Iliad or the Odyssey, or throughout any ancient literature, the biggest warrior kills off his opponents, gets the honor, the glory, and the power, and becomes a legend after he's dead. Jewish leaders, a judge, was first and foremost a leader in Torah. So he couldn't be just a big muscle. He had to be a brain. And Jewish leader, we never, from traditional Jewish perspective, you know, modern Zionist thing is they're definitely as glorification of certain people in Jewish history, like Judah, Maccabee, David. And that's a revisionist idea. Because when I get into Zionism, we'll see the idea of forget the passive ghetto Jew. We want the macho fighting Jew. So they deliberately pick certain characters in Jewish history and glorify them. But the traditional view on these people is, first of all, the greatness of someone like a King David, who we'll look at later, or even of a Samson. It's not his physical strength. It's his moral strength. It's his knowledge of Torah, because he wouldn't have got the job otherwise. I always say it's very interesting to show you the different idea that we have about strength versus anywhere else. You know, the rabbis say, you know, Ezechu Agibor, Hakovesh et Yitzro, who is the strong man? Someone who conquers himself. Controlling yourself is loving yourself is a big challenge, and learning to control yourself is a big challenge. It's very easy for a big muscle guy to smash things around and kick things and beat people up and be a tyrant. It's not a great man. A great man in Judaism is, first of all, someone who conquers himself. Okay, that's true strength. There's almost no one in Jewish history who's glorified as a macho hero. You have some Jewish leaders who were macho heroes, but that's not how we look at them and their greatness. A little side point of tribute, it's very interesting. Anyone who protects you anywhere in the world, you hire someone to protect you. I've checked like over a dozen languages so far. It's all the same thing. What's that person called?
A bodyguard.
You know, in Judaism, you know what it's called? No, in body, it's called a shomer rosh, a head guard. It's very interesting. I haven't found any other language. If anyone knows another language,
football.
No, in Spanish is a bag, one of the spells, which means like a bag, you protect your bag.
You protect your bag. Okay, so even that's interesting, you're a bag. In Judaism, the thing that counts is the head, and that's what you protect, and that's what makes you great. Not who you can punch and who you beat up and how much you bench press. Yes, sir?
Prostitution is not illegal.
Sorry?
Prostitution is illegal.
There is such an idea it's not. In Jewish law, you're not supposed to have prostitution. So don't make prostitutes of the daughters of Israel. You have, as they call, the world's oldest profession is found everywhere. There is. By the way, there is a difference between, I don't want to get into it now, there's a difference in Jewish law between a prostitute versus what's called the pilegish, which a pilegish is like a concubine, which is not the same thing. It's not a woman who's selling her body, but it's a woman who doesn't have the legal status of being married. Let's not get into it now. But no, prostitute it's forbidden from the Torah. It says don't make prostitutes of the daughters of Israel. No, you're not allowed to do it. But you have such characters. It's, you know, you have, and again, we don't whitewash it. Again, as I say, it's the oldest trade on the planet Earth. So, okay. Now, just to talk about Samson, he's such an interesting character. You know, you read, they made a movie in the 50s, I think it was, with Victor Mature. I doubt anyone's seen this movie. Now, Samson, you've seen the movie? I haven't seen it. I remember as a little kid seeing this movie. I don't even remember most of it, but I remember it was a typical Hollywood remake. He's a classic case of a story that's very much distorted. Samson, the big enemy, by the way, of the Jewish people at this time, the big enemy of the people called the Philistines. Not the Goldsteins, the Philistines. The Philistines are, we now know a lot about them. They are a seafaring people who are going to inhabit the coast of Israel. They come from somewhere in the Mediterranean. They settle in the late Bronze, early Iron Age, primarily on the coast of Israel. There are five big Philistine cities. There's Ashdod, Yaffa, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Yaffa, Gaza. Gat and Ekron are the five big Philistine cities in the land of Israel. There are also several Philistine cities up north in what is today Lebanon. They're seafaring people. You know, it's interesting. The term Philistine has very negative connotations. If you call someone a Philistine, it's like you're a boor. You're uncultured. But we know now, thanks to people like Trude the Dotans, who are the world's experts on Philistine excavations in the land of Israel, that they were actually a very sophisticated culture. They actually had, technologically, they were far more advanced than the Jewish people. They had they really perfected the creation of iron tools and iron weapons. And you'll see that much of the story of the dominance of one culture or one civilization over another has to do with that culture's ability, whoever has the technological edge and knows how to use that edge. It's not just having the edge, it's knowing how to use it strategically. Like we'll see, the Chinese may have invented gunpowder, but it is Europe that figures how to create standing armies, train standing armies, and employ the gun in a way that makes it a very effective weapon. Okay, it's interesting. Sorry?
Were they large also?
Yeah, there's lots of Philistines occupying the whole. Now, we see the description in the Bible, which we now know to be correct today through archaeology, is the Philistines, who are seafaring people, land on the coast, settle in the coast, occupy the coastal plain area, which is why, till today, I always call Tel Aviv the land of the Philistines. It has a lot to do with the culture there, in my opinion, also today. But and they're also encroaching on the Jewish people who are in the highlands. Now, why do they come? Well, if you look at the real politics of it, they come because there are seafaring people looking for places to settle. But in the Jewish perspective, we say they come because we're not doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing in the land. And God tells us, look, you only get the land if you know how to use it properly. So the Philistines are always trying to encroach on the Jews. And sometimes there's peaceful coexistence, but there's all kinds of fighting. The Philistines are the big enemy. There's other peoples also, but they're the number one enemy. It even describes how the Jews would take their iron tools down to the coast to have them sharpened by the Philistines. You know, Philistine hardware, you know, now they have a website for that or something, you know, sharpenaxe.com or something. But so Samson is one of the people who has to deal with the Philistines. Now, he deliberately goes and marries a Philistine woman to start up with the Philistines. I don't want to go through all the stories, but he does all kinds of terrible things to them. He wants to provoke them. Now, Samson's unusual. Great story. He's a Nazir. From birth. A Nazir, there's an idea of a Nazirut, which is the closest thing we have in Judaism to like a priest. Like an abstinence of some kind. I don't mean a Catholic priest. A Nazir never cuts his hair and doesn't touch any grape products, no wine. Now, normally it's a period of a month and it's as a form of penitence. Samson's one of these superhuman guys who never cuts his hair and has superhuman strength because of his hair. It's not a normal story here. You don't have any other examples of such a guy in Jewish history. And he's like this super, he's literally a Superman. Has a story where he kills 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. He takes an ox's jaw and he sits there and he's smacking away. In the movie, I remember that one scene, he's like whacking away at them and there's this big pile of dead Philistines. I'm sure if they remade the movie, they'd get Schwarzenegger for it or something. Yeah. You know? But he'd be whacking away, you know. He'd have that great Austrian accent, you know. Go ahead, Philistine, make my day, you know. So, Jean-Claude Van, now he's not macho enough. He doesn't speak English either that well. Had to explain how Samson is from Belgium, you know. But anyway, he just have an accent. But anyway, so again, simple reading of the story, which is misreading, is big Jewish strongman falls for a gorgeous shiksa, which is not true. Okay, he deliberately marries this woman. It was a mistake, by the way. He shouldn't have done what he did. He does all these cool things, like he takes all these foxes and he ties torches to their tails and he runs them to the Philistine fields and all their crops light on fire and he's killing people everywhere and he's like an incredible guy.
He married
a shiksa. Well, Delilah is the woman in the story. I don't want to go through the whole story because we're not here to go into. It's not a story on Shoftim, but it is a guys. It's a very interesting story. Let me just go through it. And Delilah, who is still loyal to her people and realizes Samson's a major threat to Philistine stability, is always trying to figure out how he's so strong, and he keeps lying to her. And eventually, stupidly, he makes a mistake and reveals that his strength comes from his hair. And while he's asleep, he cuts off his payas. His payas is big, you know, the guy's in Meshuvim, his huge payas, you know, he's never cut them. And his strength is gone. The Philistines capture him, they blind him, they put him to work pushing this giant grindstone. And then the end of the story, which is a very, just to show you. They blind him, yeah. And he's stupidly, you know, they forget to like stop cutting his hair again. So his hair grows back. His strength comes back. They take him. They take him to the Philistine temple of Dagon, which is one of their gods. And they're gonna publicly execute him. Now his strength is back, but he can't see. And he has like a, he has one of these little slave kids, you know, like movie. I think in the movie they put Delilah there. They have to change it. It's a romance story. He has himself positioned between the columns of this temple. And he wants, what does he want to do? He wants to take the whole house with him. And he has one of the great, this is one of the great sentences in Jewish history in terms of like Jewish martyrdom. He says, Tamut nafshi im plishtim, let my soul die with the Philistines. And he pushes the columns apart and the whole temple collapses and he takes like the entire like Philistine monarchy with him. And it says he killed more, he commits an incredible act of Kiddush Hashem. He dies, you know, to defend the Jewish people, which is what we say Kiddush Hashem is about in its ultimate level, giving your life for the Jewish people. And it says he killed more people then than he killed in the whole rest of his life. And that's the end of one of these very interesting stories in the book of Judges. Yes, sir?
One question on how Shimshon said, I know, sort of saying the prophet tells the land of the cities and killing 1,000 Philistines with a skull of an ox. It doesn't seem like within the clothes of the last Jewish guy.
Well, nice Jewish guys. It's a, ever hear the question? It's like all this bloodshed. There's a lot of violence in all these books of the Bible. Okay. Now, and by the way, I'm glad it bothers you. It should bother you.
And on top of that, it seems like it's nothing about because they're being threatened or the Jews are being kind of out of anger. And they killed him out of anger.
Well, part of it's revenge. There's a revenge story in there that they killed part of his family. No, he is some of it's revenge against the enemies of the Jews. But no, ultimately what is going on is these Philistines are a serious threat. And he wants to start up with them so he can get rid of them because they don't belong in the land of Israel. Now, the question of, it's an excellent question, of all this bloodshed and all this violence. We're going to talk about, like by the next class, about killing a Molech. You know, there's a commandment in Jewish law to commit genocidal war against another people. Now, the fact that it bothers us, by the way, in the ancient world, no one would bat an eye at this story. They'd be like, yeah. As a matter of fact, a very interesting little piece of trivia, when the Christian bishop Ulfilas, I think it's in the 5th century, brought the Bible to the Germanic peoples of Northern Europe to convert them, he dumps the whole book of Kings out of the Bible. Why? Because they were so incredibly warlike to begin with. He was afraid to give them these stories. All he needs is a bunch of Germans thinking they're on a holy war. You know, they're going to kill everyone. They're always belligerent in history. So the question is that for Jews, the difference is that, by the way, Jews have to be told to go fight. It's not a Jewish thing. It's very clear over and over again the rabbis say the way a Jew is supposed to be in his soul is to be rachmanim bashanim begom lechasidim, merciful, modest, and doers of kindness. We have to be told by God, you know, God has to like kind of schlep us out, go fight, because there's good and there's evil. We taught the world. We have to remember this when you're reading these stories. The Jewish people taught the world the value of life. Okay? The Jewish people taught the world that you don't kill babies, you know, for religious reasons and have blood sport. And you don't go conquering and slaughtering people for the sake of glory and empire and to rape and to pillage. Jewish people taught the world peace is the ideal. But the Jewish people also taught the world, this is the part that so much of the Jewish world today has forgotten, that there's right and there's wrong. And it's a struggle and it's a battle and it's the ultimate battle. Okay? Which is a lot of the reason for what anti-Semitism is about. And there are times you have to fight your enemies. But the question is to know when. And at this period of time in history, when we have a God and we have prophets, today no one, anyone who thinks they're doing the will of God by blowing themselves up in a bus or in a shopping area is evil. He's not doing the word of God for two reasons. A, God doesn't tell people to do such things. And B, no one has prophecy today. Certainly not Islamic suicide bombers are not connected to prophecy. So today, we don't walk around doing this stuff, not as a Jew and not as a Gentile. But in the ancient world, when you had a direct connection to God, the creator of the universe says, this person's an enemy, you have to get rid of them. And by the way, we got to remember that the real problem is not them, it's you. You won't have this problem if you deal with you. You keep the Torah, you won't have to worry about Philistines or anyone else, or Amalekites or anyone else. But you got to remember, but if I tell you, the very famous quote, we get this King Saul, I don't want to let the cat out of the bag too early, but as the rabbis say in the Talmud, it's a very famous quote, don't be too big a tzaddik. You know, not, I hate to use the expression, but I love it, you know, not in a yeshiva. Don't be more Catholic than the Pope. Okay, if the creator of the universe, God, it's such an important idea. God is by definition truth. God is by definition morality and right. God can't tell you to do something that's evil or wrong. If you see something happening in the world, or if God tells you to do something and you think it's wrong, then you're not understanding what God's doing. But come on, we're talking about the infinite creator of the universe here. It's a very profound idea. We could discuss it for hours. But it's fundamental to understand what's going on here. It should bother us that we have to kill people. When a Jew gets comfortable killing people, it's bad news. that Golda Meir said it. Very interesting quote. I don't necessarily agree with it, but it says a lot about Jewish nature. She said, "I can forgive the Arabs for killing Jews, but I can't forgive them for making us kill them." It's not a Jewish thing to do it, but sometimes we have to. Okay, and you don't deal with your enemy because you think that God's being too harsh. Believe me, your enemy's going to deal with you. It's a very, very important lesson in Jewish history. We get to King Saul and Amalek, which will be the next class. We'll see very clearly what a mistake it is to think you're being more righteous or more correct, or to be weak when you're given a commandment to do something. Yeah. No, but he was the judge. He wasn't doing the wrong. He made some mistakes. His mistake was not going after the Philistines. That was the right thing to do. His mistake was the way he did it. Okay. The thing he does with the Philistine woman is a mistake. Okay? He makes a mistake. The people, we don't want to watch the mistakes. I don't want to go into the detailed analysis. You know, get a good book on the book of Judges with commentary, and you can read all the commentary saying what he does wrong, what he does right. But we can never look at these people like their characters in Dallas or Melrose. The mistakes they're making are on an incredibly high level. Would that we had a Samson today.
It just seems, you know, when you say they're on a high level, from David and Bathsheba to Samson and Delilah, I know what you're thinking. I mean, I know possibly what you're thinking of that. But it just seems like, and the Jewish people in the desert complaining about this and that, it seems like just like normal complaints that any one of us, if we're in the situation, might entertain to speak up about. So when you say they're on a high level, I understand the concept of that, but looking about what they're complaining about, what they're going through, it seems like it's pretty real.
Well, complaints versus mistakes. The mistakes are things we make more mistakes in one day. I make more mistakes in a minute of my life than Moses made in his entire existence. No, hands down. 1 minute of my life. No, hands down. Mistakes and complaints are different things. Yes, I would also complain if I was walking through the desert for 3 days with no water. But I would complain a lot more loudly than the Jewish people did. We have to understand the magnitude of the complaint and what the magnitude of the mistake they're making. They're much smaller. Believe me, they're the things we wouldn't need. The mistakes being made are things you wouldn't recognize.
You have instances in the Holocaust where some people acted like animals, but there was a good portion that I know that acted like they said saints. Someone said that they saw rabbis turn into less than human beings, and they saw other people rise up
right.
To levels of incredible, levels
right.
That no one ever would think of. So, I don't know. I mean,
No, first of all, in all human history, throughout all time, even modern times, people have tremendous potential. There are great people in the world today. But I'm saying in general, the point is not how low we are, but the point is how high the people are in that generation and how much we can get a distorted picture of what's really going on based on a simple reading of the text. And maybe after we'll talk about it more because I don't want to get too much into it now. But by the way, the story of Ruth, which is one of the books of the Bible, very interesting book, very interesting story. If you're familiar with it, also takes place during this period of time with the judges. And Ruth is a very unusual character. She's a convert. She's the classic convert to Judaism. By the way, from her comes King David. It's also interesting, another great example of not whitewashing the origins of even the greatest characters in the Jewish people. But that's a story that actually is fixed in this period of time in history. So we have this period of the judges, which goes up and goes down. Sometimes the Jewish people rising and falling, again, in our level of spirituality, our connection to God, and therefore suffering because of the Philistines and other enemies, and the judges redeeming us. And this is what's going on for a period of close to 400 years. At the end of this period of time, and the last person I want to talk about today, because tomorrow we're going to start with the monarchy, the last of the judges is a man by the name of Samuel, who's one of the most important prophets in Jewish history. Wrote the book of Samuel according to Jewish tradition, amongst other things that he wrote. He's like the grandfather of all the prophets in many respects. Not that he's the greatest prophet, but he's very significant in his role in Jewish history and his impact as a prophet. Samuel is a very strong character, an extremely righteous person. The Jewish people have now gone through close to 400 years of no strong central leadership. It's a level of responsibility that is very hard to live on. Okay, it's hard. You have to live in the real world. We're not talking about open miracles so much here. Not like in the desert. Making decisions, living with external threats, okay? And the people are tired of it, okay? They couldn't maintain the level. Now, interesting, in the book of Deuteronomy, in Shoftim, which is chapter 17, verses 14 through 19, It says, listen to this, it says, when you come into the land which the Lord your God gives you, place a king over yourself, whom the Lord your God shall choose. He will not have too many horses, neither shall he have too many wives, neither shall he have too much silver and gold. And it shall be that when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of the Torah, etc., etc., etc. So we have a commandment in the Bible to put a king over ourselves. Now, the Jewish people have been living for close to four centuries without a king. No central leadership. In a difficult situation, in many respects. They go to Samuel, and they say to Samuel, and here's what this is from 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 5 through 7. It says, and they, the people, said to Samuel, okay, I'm adding in to Samuel, behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now set up for us a king to judge us like all the nations. And the thing was displeasing in the eyes of Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people according to all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from reigning over them. What's the obvious question? There's an obvious question here. I just read you from...
Why is God telling him instead of just sending the plague upon the people?
Sorry?
Why is God just like sending the Philistines?
No, but why is God angry at the Jews for asking for a king when there's a commandment to put a king over yourself?
They're not asking for the right king.
Exactly. Max hit it. Exactly. We're asking for the wrong kind of king. Max gets an extra helping of dessert.
Yeah.
There is no dessert, so that's an easy thing to promise, right? There's a right kind of king and a wrong kind of king. What's a Jewish king? A Jewish king is supposed to walk around with a Torah scroll strapped to his arm all the time. It's supposed to be a model of what an ideal Jew is all about, a figurehead for the rest of the nation to emulate. Not a big, despotic, strong bully with a whip who orders people around and has people's heads cut off. That's a Gentile king. Okay? We say, it says, Som tasim alecha melech. Place, you Jewish people, place a king over yourself, the right kind of king for a special nation. Okay? We say to Samuel, give us a king like all of the Gentiles have. A big, strong guy so we can sit back, throw off that heavy burden of responsibility we have to deal with on a day-to-day, live, get rid of that, you know, got it to God and right decisions. It's hard to do that. It's much easier in many respects to have someone decide for you, which is why the Talmud says an interesting thing. In many respects, it says a slave is happier being a slave. I'm not talking about a guy being whipped. We're talking about a slave who's living in a pleasant environment. He will give up his freedom to know that he's being taken care of and decisions are being made for him. In many ways, I can tell you personal experience, when I go into the army and I do Miluim, you do reserve duty in the army. It's interesting, you know, what do you have to do? You have to get up in the middle of the night and drive around a Jeep for 8 hours. It's cold, sometimes it's not so pleasant, it's boring, it's monotonous. But in many ways, it's the best vacation I have. Because what's my decisions I have to make in the Army? I have to make a decision. Not basically nothing. I'm not an officer. I joined late, thank God. I don't have to make any decisions. I'm not responsible to anyone but myself. I have to make decisions. To get up at 3 a.m., do I want a cup of Turkish coffee or not so my eyes will be open? You know, do I want to eat or take a shower now? And I don't have to worry about my job and paying bills and kids and da, da, da.
Not like being a sheep,
exactly, right. Okay, so we ask for the wrong kind of king, and we're going to get someone who is not a bad person, but is not the ideal kind of king for us. Okay, so we're going to end now. We're ending now with the period of the end of the Judges. And Samuel, who, by the way, is going to die at age 52, he's going to rule as a judge for 13 years. The last 2 years, he's going to co-lead the Jewish people with the first Jewish king, whose name is Saul. And we're going to pick it up with Saul, who's the first monarch of the Jewish people, and we'll talk about Saul and then David and Solomon tomorrow.
This program is part of a series. For the continuation, please insert the next disc.